May I begin by thanking the Fathers for giving me this lovely opportunity to be here among you all. The church looks a bit bigger somehow. Oh, good stuff. I thought my eyes were playing up for a minute there. Oh, that's very nice. That's lovely. Thank you very much. They say that when you go back to visit a place that you knew when you were young, you generally tend to find that it's a lot smaller than you remember. Like, you know, if you've been used to playing in your mum and dad's backyard when you were a kid, and then you go, you know, you're away for years and you come back and you go back to the backyard that you remember as being huge, then usually you find it's actually really tiny. You know, it's not as big as you thought. I thought I was having the opposite experience there for a minute. I remember this being, you know, not that big. Oh. Getting younger, that's nice. Thank you, you've made my day, Mark. Not too many people say that to me nowadays. Alrighty. We're going to start our talk today with an experiment. Now, you're going to be part of history tonight, because we're going to do an experiment that I think has never been done before in a Coptic church. Now please, before I do this experiment, I'd like to warn you, don't try this at home, okay? It's dangerous. We're going to take a glass, we have our cameraman there, yes, and we're going to tip the water into the glass. Exciting, isn't it? Okay, have we got that there? Good stuff. Yeah, now just focus on the cup, okay? Not on me, okay? You got the cup? No, no, what? He's good. Okay, now what we're going to do, this is lovely, clear, pure water, isn't it? Just makes you feel like having a drink, doesn't it? You're just sitting there all thinking, oh, I'd like to have something to drink. Now, I was going to use sugar, but I actually found something that's a little bit better. So I brought my own special secret ingredient. And this has been obtained at great risk from my mum's garden. It's a bit of dirt. Some soil. I'm going to put the dirt into the water. Now, in the best scientific tradition, I'm going to ask you to tell me, what do you think will happen when I put the dirt in the water? It will sink. Okay, are you ready? Are you watching? Are we getting this on camera? You can all see it, because you can need a close up. Okay, here we go. The dirt is going into the water. Now, we're not just going to leave it at that, we're going to stir it. Anyone still thirsty? Okay, I think we need a little bit more actually. Let's put a bit more dirt. Oh, there's a few stones and things there. Okay, here we go. A bit more dirt. Beautiful. Now, can you see the water? Now, I want you to please put this image into your mind, okay? Because all through the talk today, every now and then, we're going to come back to this cup. What we're going to do to it is we're going to put it here. And we're going to leave it. And we're going to see what happens. Okay, but I just want you to keep the image of that lovely, yucky sort of water in your brain. Okay, now you can turn the camera away, and just if you like, every, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, you're welcome to just sort of have another look at it with the camera, and we'll sort of see how it's going. Okay, so we're going to talk about purity today, and I always like to begin with a definition. What is purity? So let's start with a very simple dictionary definition. If something is pure, that means that it's had all of the contaminants removed from it. I don't think you would call this cup of water pure anymore. You'd agree with me? Because it's had lots of other stuff mixed in with it that's not just simply water. So something that's pure is something that is had all the contaminants removed. It's just one thing. And interestingly, according to that definition, you can have a purity which is good, and you can also have a purity which is evil. Have you heard the expression pure evil? Okay, that's purity as well, but it's purity at the other end of the spectrum. It's someone who's had all the good removed out of them. So I suppose that we could say that the devil is pretty pure, except the problem is that the purity in him is the purity of evil. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum we have God, who is purely good. There is no spot or sin or blemish or fault in God. He's totally pure. So we're going to talk today about the spiritual purity, which is the good purity. The purity of having sins removed. Now, I better move back, because as a typical Egyptian, I'm using my hands as I talk and I'm bumping. We don't want to bump the water, he said. We just want to keep it like that. Okay. And before I launch into this subject, I just would like to give you a little personal footnote, which is that this is not a lecture from an expert to people who need to, you know, learn from him. This is a lecture from one student to some more students, because all of us are still walking along the road of learning about purity. So, you know, I'd like you to please think with me, and please feel free to contribute any ideas or thoughts or experiences that you have, because I need to learn about purity just as much as you guys do. Okay, why is it important to be pure? Why have the Abunas thought of making this a subject? What's the point? What's the good of being pure? Well, I've come up with a few reasons why. The first one is, as we just said a minute or two ago, that God is pure. So if you want to be a follower of God, if that's the decision that you've made, that you want to belong to God, you want to be a Christian, then you have to adopt the Christ-like image. You have to follow in the path that Christ taught us to follow, and that he himself walked, and that was a path of purity. So that's the first thing, that you need to give God your whole heart. Simply being a Christian means to be pure in your motives, because Jesus asked for us to give him our whole heart. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, and all your soul, and all your mind. So a true Christian is a person who doesn't sort of have, you know, 80% of his heart is given to God, but he's just kept 20% for himself to use in for other purposes, you know, here and there and whatever. You can't be a Christian and do that. Maybe life would be easier if it was possible, but it's simply not an option that God left open to us. If you want to follow Jesus, Jesus is precious enough, valuable enough, important enough for you to give him your whole heart and your whole life. You can't just give him little bits. To have a pure heart means that you avoid hypocrisy. You avoid being, as James calls it, a double-minded person. And that's one of the things that makes life really uncomfortable and really miserable. Sitting on the fence and the stress that comes from that. I'm sure you all know what I'm talking about. The kind of time in your life where you're trying to live with God, but at the same time you really enjoy the world, or you really enjoy this particular sin, and you feel like you're in the middle of a tug of war, being pulled this way and that way and that way and this way. And then you find you get all of these horrible guilty feelings. When you do the wrong thing, you feel horrible and guilty about it. When you do the right thing, you can't really enjoy it, because you know that in your heart you still want to go back and do the wrong thing, and it just makes life really miserable. It doesn't work. So that's the second thing of the second reason why we need purity, in order to have a whole heart, not to be divided. As Jesus said, a house divided among itself cannot stand. You can't live that way. Thirdly, purity is what we were created for. That's how God actually made us to be. Think back to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and think of the life that they lived. Can you think of a more pure life than that? You know, a more pure physical life? They lived in the garden among the trees and the plants and the animals, and they sat and played with the animals and, you know, looked after the plants. Their heart was so pure that they didn't even need to wear clothes. The thought of needing clothes never even entered into their mind. They were like children. Have you ever seen little children on a hot day around a sprinkler? Like, you know, little 3-4 year olds. What do? Before you know it, they've got their t-shirt off and then the shorts come off and then the underwear comes off and yay, you know, we're running around getting all wet. Put your clothes back on. Why, mummy? You know, what's the big deal? They're pure. Their heart, their mind is just very, very pure. That's what Adam and Eve were like. They were just, you know, what's the big deal? Sin hadn't even entered into their mind. And that's the way that God wants us to be. That's the way that we find peace. That's the way that we find fulfillment of our lives. That's where we find our comfort and our rest. When we live according to the instructions that the Maker gave for us. And those instructions include to have a pure heart. And the last reason I came up with is freedom. Purity sets you free. Purity allows you to live without fear, without anxiety. Because if you've made a decision and you've decided that God is it, He is your Lord, and that's it. My life belongs to God. This is what I'm setting out to do. I'm going to follow Him no matter how hard it is. But I'm going to follow Him, I'm going to seek that purity. Then you find yourself gradually being separated from the sins that can enslave a person. You know, again, as the Gospel says, he who commits sin is a slave to sin. So when we allow those sins to get in and contaminate our purity, and we allow them to continue there, we actually become chained by those sins. We become slaves to those sins. And you can't escape. A person who escapes from those chains and returns to the purity for which God intended him or her is a person who suddenly finds themselves free. And being here reminds me of when I was a teenager and I used to come to church on a Saturday morning, attend the Mass, have confession with Abuna. And I used to ride my bicycle home because I couldn't drive yet. And I used to ride my bicycle home after confession thinking I could just go flying off into the air. Have you seen E.T.? You know the movie? You know the bit at the end where the guy's just flying off into the air on his bicycle? I was actually, you know, this is before E.T. was made, okay? But I felt I could fly. You know, I was just so happy. You know, I was jumping out of my skin with joy and happiness. Because I felt I'm free. Those horrible sins that I've been carrying around all these weeks and have been burdening me down, making me feel like a slave, holding me ransom to the devil. And now suddenly it's as if someone just came with a great big bolt cutter and chopped all of those chains off, and now I'm free. This is the freedom that Christ wishes us to live in. Look, in the end, we are strangers on this earth. And this is a fact. We live our life on the earth because God gave us that life. And the day will come when God will say, I want that life back. And we won't be able to say no. Not any single person in this whole world will be able to say no. So God is the owner of our life. We just borrow it. If we were the owners, we could say to Him, no, this life is mine. You can't have it. And He would leave us here. But we can't do that. So that tells us that God owns our life. And He gives it to us on loan. So we have to ask ourselves, if this is not mine, what does the owner want me to do with this life? I have to look after it. If you borrow your next door neighbour's lawnmower, and you know that he's really, really sensitive about smashing it into fences and trees and things, okay, you would be a horrible person if you took that lawnmower and went smashing it into fences and trees. You'd have a lot more respect than that. You'd say, I'll use it carefully according to the requests of the owner. And that's what we have to do with our lives. We say, okay, God has given me this life. I have to use it in the way that He wishes me to. I have to look after it. I have to respect it. I have to take care of it, because the day is going to come when I'm going to give this life back to Him. And I need to look after it. And that's what we need to keep in our minds so long as we dwell on this earth. We are strangers. Our real life is not the life that we live here. Our real life is the life that we will live in eternity. So we have to keep our goals clear, and we have to keep our goals pure. That's the easy part. Okay, so far that's good. How do you actually go about living a pure life? And the questions that John was asking before the talk began really bring out the difficulty of living a pure life, I think. I think that was a really good exercise. Because it's all very good for us here to sit in church and the Buddha says, you must all be pure, and we all nod our heads and say, yes, of course, Buddha, we all want to be pure. But of course, life is never that simple. As a very wise and famous person once said, life wasn't meant to be easy. And it wasn't. It's really hard. The devil is very clever. He knows lots of ways to stop us from achieving our goals. He knows lots of little detours that he puts in our way to distract us and take us off the path. So what do you have to do to live a pure life? As I said to you at the beginning, I don't have all the answers, but I'm just going to share with you a few of the strategies from one soldier in the army to the others. I think before we talk about any practical things that you can do, the first and most important ingredient to living a life of purity is to have a pure heart. You have to begin from the inside and work your way out. If you try and do it backwards, you might succeed for a while, but you will never succeed permanently. And our Lord Jesus said this very, very clearly. He said, you Pharisees, you want to wash the outside of the cup and the saucer, and you don't bother about what's inside. First clean the inside, and then the outside will also be clean. If I don't have a pure heart, and I follow all of those rules that you guys just discussed, okay, I'm not going to go to clubs or parties, I'm not going to drink or smoke or do any of that stuff, I'm going to, you know, switch the television off, I'm not going to go to movies, I'm not going to do this and that and the other, okay, but my heart is still not a pure heart. Do you know what's going to happen? A couple of things might happen. One is the day will come, and the devil is very clever at making this happen, when I finally say, that's it, I can't do this anymore, I've had it. And that's when you see someone who grew up in church and seemed to be an angel, maybe a deacon and maybe even a servant, and suddenly, after a couple of months, you know, you've known them all their life and you don't see them for a few months, and then you hear, so and so has just gone totally wrong. How could that happen? His parents didn't bring him up properly, or the church has failed, or whatever. The reason usually in those situations is because the person never had a pure heart, never concentrated on the inside. All they were doing was trying to do things on the outside. And you just can't live like that forever. The day comes when you can't keep that mask up anymore, and the whole thing just collapses. That's not what God wants us to do. The other thing that can happen is sometimes you can keep on doing that, and then after a while you start finding yourself saying, I'm losing here. Here I am following all the commandments God wants me to do, and I don't have any peace. I'm not happy with my life. And you start questioning and saying, why, God? I'm doing everything you asked me to do, but I'm not happy. What's wrong? There is something wrong in what I'm doing. And we start searching and we start wondering and asking, why, God? You know, why? You promised me that if I was with you, I'd be happy. Why aren't I happy? And once again, often that's the reason. If I don't discover that reason, if I don't discover the fact that my heart has not yet become pure, then sometimes what happens is people start doubting their own faith. And this is one of the causes of people becoming atheists. They try to be Christian, but they try it in the wrong way. They try it in a superficial way. And they find that it's not satisfying. Instead of questioning the way that they were approaching it, They start questioning the faith itself. Well, maybe if I'm not happy, maybe Christianity is wrong. Maybe that's the reason why it's not working. And that's not true. Unfortunately for that person, it's not true. And they might go out and search everywhere. You know the story of Saint Augustine, who went and searched for 20 years. During that 20 years, he did a lot of sins. But that wasn't the worst thing. The worst thing was the fact that he was trying to find the truth, trying to find what he needed. Like, you know, the old expression, he had a hole, something missing in his heart, and he couldn't find anything to fill it. And he tried a whole lot of different religions, and none of them ever satisfied him. And amazingly, and this is the amazing work of God, all of that time while he was out searching, God looked at his heart and saw that what he had was a purity of purpose. Because when he was about 14, 15, Saint Augustine read a book by one of the old Roman philosophers, and this book said that the most important thing in life was the search for truth. Seek truth above all else. And Saint Augustine loved this, and he said, I'm going to make this my motto. I am going to seek for the truth. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, he rejected the religion of his mother and searched in all of these other places. But he was genuinely searching for the truth. And because of this, after he'd gone for that 20 years, eventually God brought him to a bishop called Ambrose, who started to speak to him about Christianity deeply and profoundly rather than superficially. And because of the purity of his heart and the purity of his goal, it immediately clicked, and he said, this is what I've been needing all of this time. This is what I've been searching for. And he, after some initial, you know, fears and anxieties, he embraced it with everything that he had. And after he became Christian for a while, he started to feel that restlessness again. He started to feel unhappy again. And you might say, well, why? Okay, you know, what else do you want, God? Here he is, he's come back. He stopped being, you know, a pagan and a Manichae and all of these weird things. And now he's come back to your church. Why haven't you given him peace? Ah, says God, this man's heart is so pure that just being a Christian is not enough for him. And God allowed him to have that restlessness and anxiety for a while, until he picked up a verse in the Bible and he read, come on, now is the time for you to leave your sins. Put behind you all of that stuff that you've been doing and come and live a pure life with God. And he said, yes, this is what I'm doing. I've still held on to some of those old sins. I still had some of those old habits in my heart. What can I do, Lord? What can I do to get rid of them? And then God led him step by step to read the biography of Saint Anthony that was written by Saint Athanasius. And he said, aha, this is what I need. And so he devoted himself and turned his house into a monastery and gathered a few more of his friends who were wanting to follow the same path, and they became monks. That was what God wanted for him. And when did he finally find peace? When he'd lived in that life and followed with God and given up everything, given up all the desires of the world. A monk, as you know, gives up everything. He owns nothing. He has no stake in anything. You know, he even emotionally, he's not attached to anyone. He simply belongs to God. Like, he's the beautiful, the most complete image of the stranger on this earth. The person who wanders through the earth having no attachments. And when he did that, that's when he finally found his peace. And that was the answer to the purity of his heart. So, having looked at that example, what is a pure heart? A pure heart is a heart that is pure in its emotions, pure in its motives and its goals. Do you have that kind of a pure heart at this stage? If I were to ask you now to sit down and think honestly, what are my goals in life? What do I want in life? Would you find that they are pure goals? We were talking before about, you know, the resume, and you know, John's sort of saying, come on, you know, everybody has exaggerated at one time or another. Okay, let's just take that as an example. I'm applying for a job. I know there's 100 people applying for it. It's a top job, lots of perks, really good money, doing something I really like. I really, really want this job. I know I'm in competition with the other 100 people. I'm not even going to get an interview unless I spice up the resume a little bit, put in a few, you know, goodies here and there, and hope that nobody's going to ask. Okay, what are my motives at that moment? Please, anyone, what are my motives? You look like you know the answer. Yeah? Okay, I want to get the job, even if that means that I leave someone else behind who might actually possibly be better suited for the job than me even. True? But he may have been honest and just put down what he's actually done. I haven't been honest. I've put myself ahead of him. And I'm happy to do that. Why? The end justifies the means. True? This job is so good that it's worth it for me to, you know, be a little bit dishonest to get it. You all agree with me? Yes? No. Don't agree with me. Of course not, because now you see what I'm talking about. This is not a pure-hearted person. A person, it may be something very small, okay? It may mean simply changing a zero to a one. That may all be all that there is involved in it. I simply change a zero to a one. And I make my experience in my past job to have been from 1980 up until, I don't know, I've got the figures wrong. But anyway, you know, instead of making it 1 year, I'll make it 10 years. And I can do that just by changing one figure. Okay, a very, very small thing. But that tiny little small sin is enough to keep you out of heaven. That one little sin is enough to keep you out of heaven. Not because God is like this master accountant up there who has the big books and, you know, okay, now this guy's got no, that's bad. He's done a sin. He can't come to heaven. That's it. He's out. But because you can't enter into heaven if you don't have a pure heart. Like we said, God is pure. Heaven is pure. And nobody who is not pure in heart can enter into heaven. It makes sense. If I enter into heaven and bring my sin with me, bring my impure heart with me, then heaven is no longer pure, is it? A blemish has entered into heaven. So it can't happen. What's even worse is that if I continue to be impure, if I leave my heart as impure, I may not even want to get to heaven. You think about it. Heaven is the place of purity. It's the place where goodness is everything. And there is nothing there but goodness. If I'm the kind of person who wants a little bit of spice, you know, a little bit of extra stuff, goodness is too boring for me, I need to do these things to sort of feel comfortable, I'm not going to like heaven. And God's going to know that, and he's going to say, sorry, but you don't belong here. It's not that God is kicking me out. It's that I have chosen not to be in heaven. That's what we do when we decide to not have a pure heart. Now, before you sort of start getting upset and cranky and saying, oh, you know, come on, who's going to make it into heaven then? Nobody's going to make it into heaven. This is too hard. I may as well give up. I may as well just go out and do my sins and whatever. No, 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 that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying this to get you frightened and scared. Although if you got a little bit frightened and scared and that made you repent, I wouldn't mind. But I don't want you to freak out, okay? That's not the purpose of the story. The thing is that you can only be good or bad. You can only live in light or darkness. Can light and darkness coexist in the same place? Is it possible to have light and darkness in the same place? Is it? It's impossible, isn't it? Because they're, by definition, darkness is the absence of light, isn't it? Okay, light actually exists. It's an electromagnetic radiation. It's something that's there. It's an energy. The place where there is no electromagnetic radiation, no light, is darkness. So you can't have them both in the same place. You're either dark or you're light. And the devil makes us fall asleep. He quietens our conscience and says, oh, it's all right. Don't worry about it. Everybody in the world does this. You know, it'll be all right. And he gives us all these reasons why it's okay to keep a foot in both camps. But the reality is, you can't. You just can't do it. You need to have a pure heart that says, I love God or I love the devil. Either I love holiness or I love evil. To put it in the simplest terms possible, either I love good or I love bad. It's as simple as that, and it has to be one or the other. As I'm sure all of you probably have by now, you probably wouldn't be here in church on a Thursday evening if you weren't keen to be on the side of good. But the problem, as you all know, of course, is that once you've decided to do that, what happens is it's never that simple, is it? Because the devil comes along and gives you doubts, the devil makes you fall into a sin, and then you start questioning yourself. You start questioning your motives. Did I really make that decision so firmly? Well, if I did, how can I fall into this sin? Can I tell you one of the verses in the Bible that troubled me the most as I was growing up? I mean, this one really, really bugged me. It really took away my peace. Is that verse in the first letter of St. John, which says, he who loves God does not sin. Okay, it's very simple. St. John is really blunt in that letter. He who loves God does not sin. And I kept putting that verse in front of me and saying, well, I can't love God, can I? Because I sin every day. Every day of my life, I sin. And here is the Bible saying to me, he who loves God does not sin. You can't put those two together. Logically, I'm in trouble. What does that mean? Do you have an explanation for that? Does anyone? Yeah?
At the moment of sin, you are not loving God. But after the sin, you realize God.
How old are you, do you mind my asking?
21.
Oh, I feel this big. I didn't cotton on to that until I was about 30. That's very good. That's exactly true. The thing that finally gave me peace is exactly... Sorry, what's your name?
David.
Ah, that's why. See, David had a heart after the heart of God. He was pure-hearted. That's why he knew about that. But that's true. I think at the moment that you commit a sin, that's the moment when you reject God and you sort of, you put him. I don't think you can possibly have a clear image, a true image of God in your mind and commit a sin. I think it's impossible. You couldn't do it. So in order to sin, what the devil has to do is he has to remove that clear and present image of God from our minds. And once he's managed to do that, then he's free to work and get us to fall into sin. So that's true. That hour of my day, well, for me it's like 24 hours of the day, or 23 and a half hours of the day, when the devil has made you so busy with something else that you're not actually thinking about the presence of God, you're not actually feeling the presence of God. So at that time you're not really loving him. Your heart is no longer pure love for God. That's when he can start to work and make you fall into sin and so on. But what happens, of course, is that afterwards we come back and we say, God, I do love you. Okay, the devil tricked me. He put the wool over my eyes. He made me forget that I love you, and that's why I fell into sin. But God, I do love you. In spite of my human weakness, in spite of the limitations of my concentration, my short attention span, in spite of that, God, I really, really do love you. So I beg you, please forgive me for what I've done, and help me to love you more. Help me to increase my attention span. Forgive me for having hurt you and for what I've done to you. But please, God, don't give up on me. Don't leave me. Because if you leave me, who else will I go to? Who else will I find? And that's what being a Christian means. That's what, for us, in our fallen, weak state, loving God means. It means that we fall But every time that we fall, if you really love God, you will swallow your pride, you will throw away your despair. We love to wallow in despair, don't we? There are times when we really, really like to do that. We love to just sit there and say, oh, isn't life terrible? Oh, I'm so horrible. I'm so miserable. I'm no good. I'm never going to be any good at this. And it gets so you really enjoy it. You know, you feel good about how bad you are, sort of thing. And it's a kind of a comfort, I think. I don't know. I don't know why we do it. Put that aside. Don't do that. Just get up and go back to God. Go back in your room and pray. Go back to Abuna and confess. Kneel in front of God, bow in front of Him and say to Him, God, it's not about me. I want to be with You. I want You to be the centre of my life. I'm not going to sit here and wallow in this, you know, self-pity. No, I'm going to get up and I'm going to try again. And that's what loving God means. That's what being with God means. Is this microphone making a funny noise or is it just my ears ringing? Okay, I think I better move it away and see if that helps. I don't know. Good. Okay. One of the other things, I'll just say a little note before we go on to the really, you know, the nitty-gritty of the how of purity. You also need to be careful that you don't fall into the trick of losing the purity of your heart through things that seem to be good. The devil is not always, you know, straight out evil. Sometimes he puts on the disguise of an angel of light. So he doesn't always take away your purity by making you sin an obvious sin. Sometimes he takes away your purity by getting you to do something good, something nice. I'll take an example. Okay, look, here's a nice one. I remember there was once a discussion amongst a group of servants about a situation that apparently happened in Egypt. That there was a servant who had to do an art assignment. And part of his assignment was to study various types of advertising. Okay, normal stuff. Okay, so he went and he was walking around the streets looking for something, and one of the things he saw was at the movie theatres there was this beautiful big poster advertising a movie. It's very artistic and lots of different styles and so on. So he was standing there looking at it, you know, really carefully and attentively. And some of his Sunday school kids happened to be walking past, and they saw, you know, Ammu standing there at the movies looking at this movie advertisement. So they went back, and who did they tell? They told Abuna. Oh, Abuna, you never believe it. Our Sunday school teacher was standing there looking at a movie advertisement. And Abuna called this servant. He said, what are you doing at the movies? Don't you know that you're a Sunday school servant? What kind of an example is this that you're giving? Now, this probably would make... Oh, thanks, John. The solutions are so simple sometimes, aren't they? Exactly, that's right. See, purity of sound, you see. When the microphone is being contaminated with the sounds from the other microphone, it was horrible. But once we have it just now, one single sound coming in, it's excellent. Lovely. I couldn't have thought of a better demonstration myself. So, in Egypt, you know, there's this big thing about, oh, the movies, they're evil, they're bad, etc., etc. You know, you mustn't go there and so on. So the servant said, oh, I'm sorry, Abuna, you know, I didn't mean to be a stumbling block to the others. I'll apologise to the kids and so on. Okay, what do you think about this story? Do you think the servant really did anything wrong? You don't? Most people are sort of shaking their heads and saying no. Do you think he meant to do anything wrong? Definitely not. He didn't, did he? He was just innocently doing his assignment, you know, researching for his assignment. Okay. Now, you're all probably sitting there thinking, oh, you know, how old-fashioned, you know, how limited. But do you know that each one of you guys probably do exactly the same thing? Because every time that you take a decision to do something because you're afraid of what people will think of you, you're doing exactly the same thing. That's what the problem was in this case. Abuna didn't say to him, you are evil for looking at that poster. He said to him, what you did is wrong, because other people will see you and then they will think that you're doing something wrong, and then they will think that they can do the same thing wrong, and so on and so on and so on and so on. Okay? Which is true. We mustn't be a stumbling block to others. But how much of what you do is, towards God I mean, is sincere because you really believe in it and you want to do it? And how much of what you do is because of what other people think? Because that's one of those things which is a kind of a really sneaky trick from the devil that he uses to take away our purity. I love to come to the Mass. Wonderful. I just love the atmosphere and so on. Terrific. Okay. One day I wake up and I think to myself, oh, I don't really feel like going to the Mass today, but I'll go because if I don't go, then people will think that I've been lazy. Okay, so I get up and I go to the Mass. Is that ideal? Is that going from a pure heart? Once again, I'll come back and I'll ask you, what are my motives? What's my motive in that situation? What do you think? Yeah, am I doing it for the love of God? Not really, am I? I'm doing it because I don't want people to think I'm lazy. I'm doing it because I don't want my reputation with other people to fall or to collapse or to become worse. But I'm not doing it really out of love for God. Now, if that happens to you, please come to church. Don't stay at home, okay? Because when you come, you never know. God might work in your heart and then, you know, you start loving the Mass again and feel good about being here. You know, anything that brings you closer to God, by all means do it. But what I'm saying is you have to be really, really careful. Because if you allow things like that to increase in your heart and in your life, eventually they take over. And then you've got nothing sincere left. And that's like being an empty shell, like, you know, that guy we were talking about before, the superficial person who just does things on the outside and inside they never feel peace. Well, that's how you get there. So please be very, very careful about that. Okay, before we get into some nitty-gritty stuff, can we have a bit of camera action? Now, we're going to have a look. Before you look, do you remember what it looked like? Remember how yucky and stuff it was? Okay, can we have a look now? And I might, just to help you along, I'll see if we can put a little bit of a white background. I don't know if this will help or not. How are we going? Gosh, it's turned blue. What do you think is going to have happened to it? Does that look any different? It does, doesn't it? What's happened to it? It's settled, hasn't it? It's cleared up a little bit. You agree? And I haven't touched it, haven't done anything to it. Okay, just sat here, you all saw it, it was on the table. I didn't touch it. And it started to clear up. We're getting a little bit closer to pure water that we started with, aren't we? Okay, this is the first trick or strategy. That's a better word. The first strategy that I want to put to you tonight about how to achieve a pure heart. And in fact, what I'm going to do is I've got about five strategies, and it's a bit of a science lesson tonight. Okay, I apologise to those of you who are diligently trying to escape from science because you're sick of it, but that's what we're doing tonight. So the first strategy for achieving purity of heart and purity of your life, we're going to call it sedimentation. Okay, that's, I think, the technical word, is that right? Yes? Sedimentation, where you leave a liquid for a period of time and all of the gunky stuff in it gradually sediments. It falls to the bottom and then the water up the top is left as being very pure. Now, what does this mean? It means that if you want to have a pure heart, you have to sit still every now and then. If you're the kind of person whose life consists of a continuous rushing around, doing this and then doing that, finishing that and jumping to this and then doing that and doing that, and you get to bed at night and you just, thank God that day's over, and you collapse in your bed and you wake up with still all of these issues bouncing around in your mind, you jump up and, oh, I've got to do this and I've got to do that, I've got to do that. It is very hard to have a pure heart. Your heart has become the devil's playground, basically. he can have a field day with you. But if you're the kind of person who every now and then says, stop, the red light goes on, I hope that you could do this every day. I'm sure your confession fathers talk to you about having a quiet time, a time of retreat, where you can go somewhere and just be in peace. And you calm the waves, you calm the thoughts, calm the anxieties and the restlessnesses. You put yourself in the presence of God, remind yourself that he's there with you. And then you just sit in peace with God, maybe praying a little bit, maybe reading a bit in the Bible, maybe just opening your heart to God. In that peace, you will find all of the contaminants in your heart, they can't last. They don't like the peace. Evil doesn't like goodness. Peace is good. When you bring peace into your heart, the evil doesn't like it, and it starts to sediment, it starts to fall out, and you start to see it. You know, when this was all yucky and mucky, okay, you couldn't tell. It was just like homogeneous. It was one big brown slurry. But if you look at it now, you can actually see the difference. I don't know if you can see that up there. Can you get a real close-up, like a really close close-up? I don't know what's your name, sorry, Mr. Cameraman?
Daniel.
Daniel. They're all D's in this place. Is there anyone here whose name doesn't begin with D? Only joking, only joking. I knew that, come on. Can you come a bit closer, Daniel? Will your cord allow you? Okay, how's that? We want a really good close-up. Can you see the difference? Can you see the bottom of the cup? Oh, yeah, that's it. That's the shot we want. See the bottom of the cup? Can you see the difference now between the water and the muck? You can, can't you? It's very easy now to tell the difference. Can we just perform a bit more on this experiment? You're getting all of this? Yeah? Okay, now here we go. Yeah. Okay, now can you tell the difference? You can't tell the difference anymore. Okay? This is what you look like when you're rushing around. Okay? It's like one of those toothpaste commercials, isn't it? What was her name? What's her name? The one who used to put the chalk in the coloured water. Do you remember that ad? Mrs. Marsh, that's her. Yeah. And then, you know, she'd put the chalk in the coloured water and pull it out and, you know, break it in half. Anyway. I think we've gone off our topic a little bit there somehow. I don't know how that happened. Okay, so when you sit there in peace, you get to separate the good from the bad. And you get to purify your heart and purify your actions, because during that time of peace you come back to your goals, your pure goals, your pure motives, and you're able then to build a strategy and think, okay, this is what went wrong. Now I understand this is what I did wrong today. So tomorrow this is how I'm going to do it. And you build a strategy. So if you don't stop and have that time of peace, you're not going to have time to think about these things. But if you do, then you actually can think ahead and plan what you need to do. Okay, the second one, you can sit down, thanks Daniel. The second one, and I'm not going to do a demonstration on this one, is fire. Okay, fire is something that purifies things. So if you, say, you know, all the recycling and stuff that goes, oh, actually, maybe that's not a good example. But if you have, say, a metal that's been mixed into a whole lot of burnable stuff, then you burn away the burnable stuff and all you've got left then is the metal, which doesn't burn. For example, that's how they purify gold. That's how they purify silver, or they used to in the old days. I don't know if they still do it now. And the idea being that because the gold doesn't just burn away, when you apply the fire to it, all the impurities will burn away and all that you'll have left is the pure gold. If you're ever caught in the desert or on the ocean, you're shipwrecked in the ocean and you're dying of thirst, what do you do? Come on guys, you're about to die. What are you going to do? You're going to die? Why are you shaking your head? Yeah, you're going to die. If you drink the seawater, you're going to die. So what do you do? Come on, this is basic survival techniques. Yeah, someone knows up the back there. Yes, no, the gentleman whose name doesn't begin with D, the one in the black jacket. Look, you don't have a Bunsen burner, strangely enough, but for some strange reason you happen to have a bucket and a bit of glad wrap and a rock. And a cup, and a little cup. Yeah, that's it. Sort of, yeah. Okay, see what you do, you get the bucket, you fill it up with seawater. Okay, you get a cup, an empty cup, and you put it in the middle. You get the glad wrap, you put it over the top of the bucket. You get the stone, and you put it in the middle of the glad wrap. Okay, so what happens? The sun hits the water and makes it hot. The water evaporates. Okay, it goes up and condenses on the inside, on the bottom of the glad wrap. Because there's the rock in the middle, eventually the drops of water trickle to the middle and they drop into the cup. Okay, and that water that goes into the cup is 100% pure, isn't it? Because the only thing that evaporates is the water. Eventually all you'll have left in the bucket is salt. Okay, and that's true. So if I've saved your life, okay, if you are shipwrecked one day, please remember to say, you know, please God, you know, pray for me, in other words, and say, please God help him because he saved my life. Okay, and the other trick, the other important lesson is if you're going on a ship, make sure you take a bucket, some glad wrap, a rock and a cup with you. Okay, so what happens? The heat has purified the water. And sometimes that's what you need to do. Sometimes you have to apply the heat to yourself, apply the heat to your life, to your heart, in order to separate the good from the bad. Often actually it's God who does that to us. And do you know when that is? That's those times when you're crying out for God not to do that to you. The best times when God purifies our hearts are those hardest times. The times of troubles, the times of problems and difficulties, the times of failure, the times of, you know, when you feel really, really horrible and nothing seems to be going right, or you're in pain, or you're sick, or someone very close to you has passed away. They're the times that God is purifying us. It's exactly like he's applying a Bunsen burner to us. That's exactly what he's doing. He's applying that Bunsen burner, and it hurts. It hurts a lot, and that's why we cry out to God and say, please God, don't do this to me. Why are you doing this to me? But God knows. He wants you to have a pure heart. And that's, you know, St. Paul mentioned that in one of his letters, and he said that you should be like gold that is purified in the fire. And there's a verse in the Old Testament, I think it's in Proverbs, that talks about being like silver purified in a furnace. When you are going through those times, often our prayer is, please God, take this away. Please God, let this stop. But maybe what our prayer should be is, please God, let me learn what you want me to learn. Let me be purified. Let me be changed. And then you can take it away from me. But what I ask from you in the meantime, God, because I'm weak, please give me the strength to be able to bear the fire and to be able to stick through it and to continue through it until I learn the lesson that you wish me to learn. Okay, the third one is a bit of a medical one. I'm going to call it quarantine. And that's the one that most of you were talking about earlier on when we're having all of those questions. But you'll notice that it's only one of the strategies. It's not the be-all and end-all of purity. But yes, quarantine is a big help. Build an environment around yourself that encourages you to good rather than to evil. Okay? It's very simple. I'm sure if the other Rabunas were here, they would agree with me, even if I'm a priest. But if I sit every day and watch 6 hours of violence and, you know, violent movies and bloodshed and, you know, horrible stuff like that, sooner or later, that's going to affect me. That's going to disturb me. Okay, nobody is, you know, that strong. Whereas on the other hand, if I spent 6 hours a day, if God gave me the grace to do this, and I spent 6 hours a day praying and reading my Bible, my heart would later, sooner or later change, no matter how hard that heart is. One of the lovely things about Passion Week in our church is that part of the rite is that we read a whole gospel on each of 4 days of the Passion Week. And I don't know if you've ever had a chance to do it. I've only done it once, I have to be honest, in my life. And it was such an eye-opening experience. It really, really was. Because up until then, I had never actually sat down and read a gospel like you read a novel, you know, from beginning to end. And it just changed the way I was thinking completely. There were so many bits and pieces that I'd never put together before. And now I understood. Now I understood how they fit together. But not only that, by the end of it, I felt like I was living in the world of the apostles. You know that feeling? You know, like when you sort of read Lord of the Rings? You know, you've spent 3 or 4 hours because you just couldn't put it down, reading and reading and reading and reading, and then you put it down and, you know, you almost want to go out and, you know, hide the gold ring which is around the chain, you know, on the chain around your neck, and, you know, you're looking out for orcs around every corner, and, you know, because you've really just got into it. And the same thing happens. If you put good things around you, if you put holy things around you, eventually that seeps in and it gets into you. And it does change your attitude. Now you may say, oh come on, Abuna, this is like a kind of brainwashing or something, you know. What do you want to brainwash us? You just want to put us somewhere and, you know, have all this stuff bombarding us and you know, wash our brains? Well, I've got news for you. You're being brainwashed every day, whether you like it or not. Unless you live, you know, in a closed room and have no contact with the outside world, every day you are being bombarded with people and ideas who want to brainwash you. There are people who want to brainwash you into eating Mars bars. There are people who want to brainwash you into, you know, going to Luna Park or, you know, taking an overseas trip to London. Or, okay, every day people are subtly and clearly trying to get you to think the way that they want. Whether you like it or not, if you live in this world, that's what's happening. So why not choose the influences that are going to influence you? Why not choose them to help you to achieve the goal of your life rather than to achieve the goal of, you know, an advertising executive or a money-hungry businessman? Choose the ones that will help you achieve eternal life and put those around you. Is there anything wrong with watching television? Nothing at all. Watch television as much as you want. But ask yourself, is this time that I'm giving to television, is this going to help me achieve my goal of being with God and loving God? Or is it going to take me further away? The moment that the answer to that question becomes, it's taking me further away from God, that's the moment when you have to say, stop. And nobody, you shouldn't need someone to tell you that. You guys are not little anymore. We do that with little kids because they can't choose their environment for themselves, so we choose the environment for them. And we try and put a nice environment around them. But when you grow up, you choose your own atmosphere. You choose what you want to have around you. So it shouldn't come from anyone else. It should come from you. It should be your decision. Okay, Fred's story about the movies was wonderful. He reminded me of another story I heard about some youth who attended a fundraising event that was held by a group that sort of, you know, all the members are from church, but it's not actually attached to church. And they had a fundraising dinner one evening. And these youth, you know, out of the goodness of their hearts, wanted to help the poor. So they got their tickets and they turned up. And they walked in and they found that there was a disco happening, you know, and bright lights and music, and there was alcohol being served and so on. Okay, what did they do? They turned around and they walked out. Very, very simple. Nobody told them to do it. Nobody said, you know, you naughty people. They didn't do it because they were afraid to be seen there. It's a very simple question. Is this going to help me love God more, or is it going to take me away from God? And at that moment, they felt that that atmosphere was going to take them away from God. And so they did the only thing they could if their motives are pure, which is to turn around and to walk out. I'm sitting there watching television by myself. Nobody's in the house. I'm all by myself. I'm watching a really interesting movie. And along comes, you know, the usual scene with, you know, sexual references and nudity and all that stuff. Okay? Nobody can see me. Nobody knows whether I watched it or not. I ask myself, what is my motive in life? What is my goal in life? Is my motive pure? Is my love for God greater than my love for the world? And if it is, then I myself will say, this isn't going to help me. This is going to set me back 3 years in my walk with God. And I've worked too hard for me to get set back so easily. I'm changing the channel. Or I'm turning off the television altogether. Okay? Nobody told you to do it. It wasn't out of guilt or, you know, you're afraid what people will think or whatever. It's a very simple thing. I want to achieve my goal. Whatever helps me, I will do it. Whatever hinders me, I will stay away from it. The fourth one, I couldn't think of the right word for this. Maybe someone can help me. But I've called it chemical exchange. Now let me explain what it is, and hopefully someone might be able to tell me the proper word for it. You know those chemical reactions? I can see you all grimacing and saying, come on, Abuna, we hate chemical reactions. Why are you doing this to us? Okay, you know those reactions where you have a cup which has a certain compound in it, okay, which is made up of two things. Now maybe, I don't know, carbon... no, not carbon, whatever. See, I've forgotten them all now. It's terrible. What's a nice... copper sulfate, say, okay? It's made up of copper and sulfate together, and they're stuck together. And what you do is you find another element which likes sulfate more than copper does, or sulfate likes it more than the copper does. So, I don't know, does anyone know a true element? If you don't, I'll make one up. Yes? No? Okay. So, you take your test tube of Davidium, and you pour it into the cup. And what happens? The colour of the thing changes because all the Davidium gets in and kicks out all of the copper because the sulfate likes the Davidium more than it likes the copper. So all the copper gets kicked out and it sediments. Yeah. And then what you have left now is pure Davidium sulfate. Okay, how does that happen in our lives? It's very simple. A stronger attraction kicks out a weaker attraction. So if you want to have a pure heart and live a pure life, find things that attract you more strongly than sin. Now what do I mean by that? I mean, don't accept your relationship with God to just stay at one level. God is really beautiful. I can't emphasize that enough. If we were to see God, I think we would just stand there, our jaw would drop, and we would just stare at him, probably for all of eternity, because he's just so absolutely, overwhelmingly beautiful. And what do we do with that beauty? We come every Sunday to church. I hope you don't do this, but I'm saying this can be what happens. We come on Sunday to church, and instead of seeking out that beauty, we find all sorts of other things to enjoy, like what I'm going to have for lunch after I finish the Mass, and whether I'm going to meet my friend or not, and I wonder if I can tape that TV show that's on this afternoon, or will I make it in time? And we think of all of these other things to keep ourselves busy. And all the time, this incredibly beautiful Lord is there on the altar, offering himself to us. And we're just not paying any attention. We're just not even thinking about him. Isn't that crazy? Isn't that stupid? Forgive me for saying so bluntly, but it's a really stupid thing to do. So find the beauty of God. Seek the beauty of God. Maybe, and for everybody, it's different. We feel God, we experience God in different ways, according to our different personalities. For some, it might be through the beauty of nature. For some, it might be that seeing a beautiful rose makes you feel you've touched the beauty and the glory of God. For others, it might be a beautiful piece of music that you hear, or a wonderful painting, or a beautiful poem where the words all just flow and fit together so nicely, and you feel that's like a really spiritual experience, and you touch God. For some of us, it may be through prayer. It may be that when you force yourself and you stand there and you fight the battle of prayer And then you make a breakthrough and you feel the presence of God with you in that place where you're praying. And that's how you touch God. For most of us, I hope, it would be through the words of the liturgy and the tunes of the liturgy, which are so beautiful and so deep. You can study them. Look, I've been a priest for about 14 years, and every Mass I pray, I'm not kidding to you, every Mass I pray up until now, I still see something new in that Mass that I'd never seen before. A little symbolic meaning, or a beautiful little, you know, why they put that tune with that word. And when you put the two together, it means much more than either of them by themselves. All these beautiful things, they're here. The Church puts them in front of us and says, come, eat of this plenty. And if you fall in love with God, then all of those attractions of the world become like nothing to you. You know that verse in Proverbs, I think it is, where he says that the satisfied stomach was willing to tread on honey. In other words, if you feel full, you've eaten and you're full, even if someone offers you a really sweet, you know, something sweeter than honey, nowadays that verse would probably be the satisfied stomach tramples on Krispy Kremes or something like that. Okay? You just say no. It doesn't hold any attraction to you. You don't feel like having it anymore. It doesn't grab you anymore. And that's what happens. Replace the love of the world with the love of God, who is far more lovable. The more that you can do that, the more you'll find that your heart becomes purified. And not even just holy things. There are other things that at least are not evil in themselves. So, for example, keeping yourself busy with something like a sport or an activity or a hobby is much better than just sitting around and having lots of empty time, free time, where you have nothing to do. And, you know, the devil can come and play around with your thoughts and tempt you and make you, you know, basically he just chips and chips and chips away at you until he finally makes you break apart. And the last one, I'm going to call it gold plating. I think, is it electrolysis? I don't know if you can help me. How do they actually get the gold plating on the metal? They do it electrically, I think, don't they? I think that's how it works. Okay, why do they do that? Why is a gold-plated object better than a non-gold-plated object? For protection. From what? From rust, exactly. And what's rust? Corrosion. Thank you, you've just given me a different word, which is actually more complicated than the first one. What's corrosion? Yes. I think that's telling me I've gone over time, isn't it? It's like all the brains have gone to sleep. This is the last point, I promise you. What happens in rust? Electrons are lost, are they? Okay, I didn't know that, actually. All I know is I think it has something to do with the oxygen in the air, doesn't it? The oxygen in the air reacts with the metal in the metal, and they form an oxide. Is that right? And that's what the rust is. That brown stuff is when the oxygen joins onto the metal. And it's so basically it's eating away at the metal, and you get this really fragile, brittle, rusty stuff. Okay? And that's exactly the definition of how the devil takes away the purity of our hearts, isn't it? There's all this stuff floating around in the world, and if we allow that stuff to come into contact with our hearts, it reacts with our heart, and it turns something which is beautiful and strong, like a metal, into something which is fragile and brittle, like rust. And people don't value rust, do they? You never find a rust collector. Well, maybe you do, I'm not sure. For antiques, yes, that's right, antiques, that's true. But that's like artistic rust, you know. You never find someone who goes around with a jar collecting rust, because it's not valuable. And that's what the devil does. He takes our valuable, precious heart, which is so valuable and precious to God, and he turns it into worthless junk, basically, by corrupting it, by making it impure. So how can you protect against that? You get the gold plating. You put that on the outside of you. Now, what does that mean? To me, that gold plating is you change your attitude to the world. You change your attitude to life. You turn it into a 24-karat gold attitude. And by that I mean you take the words of the Gospel And you change your attitudes to fit in with those words. You change your approach to life to fit in with those words. So let's take a simple example. Let's take the sin of lust. Okay? And we know that the Bible said that even if you look at someone in a lustful way, that's a kind of adultery of the heart. You've committed adultery in the heart. You haven't done it physically, but you've committed adultery in the heart. Okay, so that's the corrosion, isn't it? Okay, the oxygen is the person that I'm looking at that interacts with my heart and causes a corrosion, which is the evil thought, the lustful thought that comes into my heart and takes away my purity. Now, what's the gold plating that I can put around my heart to prevent that from happening? The Bible teaches us that human beings were created in the image of God. True? Okay, so when I look at that person, instead of seeing something worthy of attracting lust, I can see something worthy of attracting glorification of God. I can say, God, this is a human being. You created him or her in your image. How can I look at the image of God and think these horrible thoughts? That's wrong. That's demeaning the image of God. And then you protect yourself, because that's the attitude that you have. The Bible teaches us that we should respect one another, that we should care for one another and look after one another. And I, when people come and ask me this in confession, sometimes I say this to them. I say to them, okay, that girl that you were looking at, or that guy that you were looking at, I'm sorry, I'm looking at the girls and the guys, and you know what I mean, don't you? Can I just say, I'll say them both so that nobody gets upset. Okay, that girl or that guy that you're looking at, aren't they somebody's sister? Aren't they somebody's daughter? Maybe they're even somebody's mother. If someone looked at your mother in that way, how would you feel? You'd probably want to go and bash their brains out, wouldn't you? You know, how dare you? Why? Because you have respect for your mother. Okay, how can then you look and think those things about somebody else's wife or mother or daughter or husband or son or father? Okay, how can you do that? That's a lack of respect. So once again, if you build your attitude around the teachings that God gave us, then you find that you have this automatic gold plating. It's like a protection. When the oxygen comes, it bounces off. It can't get through. There's no place for it to get through. And there are many, many more things. I'm sure that all of you, as you know, if you really sat down and thought about it, you could come up with a lot of those things of taking the word of God and applying it to a sin and seeing that that's a really, really good reason for not doing that sin. It's an excellent reason. All you have to do then is take that and build it into your attitude and change your attitude. You know, the word for repentance in Greek is the word metanoia. Nowadays we use it just for a kind of repentant prayer where we bow down. We call that a metanoia. But in the Greek language, the word for repentance is metanoia. And that word actually means a change of the mind, a change of the thought, of the way of thinking. Meta nous. Meta means to change, to go beyond. And nous means the brain. And that's what true repentance is. It's not just a change that happens on the outside. It's a change to the very way that you think. To the deepest part of who you are. Your personality actually changes. And that's what I mean by saying your approach to life changes. And that's what a truly pure heart is like. To finish, I would just like to say to you that if you want to have a pure heart, please don't expect that you will find it tomorrow. It's a very long process. It's a lifetime process. And I think all of us, you know, as I said to you at the beginning, I'm still struggling with it and fighting with it. All of us fight with it all of our life, right until the very, very last moment. Don't expect any quick answers. There are no simple solutions. There are no finger-snapping, you know, cure-alls. Life wasn't made like that. But if you have the right goal, this is the crucial thing, settle on the goal of your life and be determined to follow it through whatever happens. if you do that and you seek the grace of God to help you and the advice and the counsel of your fathers and servants who look after you, be sure that although it's a very long and hard battle, you can be equally sure that at the end you are going to be on the victorious side and you will be a winner. You will succeed. And glory be to God forevermore. Amen.